This recording is a production of Anabaptist Financial. More recordings are available on our website at www.afweb.org under the Resources menu or by calling 800-653-9817. This presentation was recorded at a business seminar held on February 19, 2026 in Belle Rive, Illinois.
When is the proper time, or is it needful, to ask for help when business isn't going the best? So at what point should a business owner take note and say, we need to ask for help? Nevin, do you want to take this one?
So I think before it gets bad, I think before it goes too far, and that's hard to draw a line there. I made a couple notes on this one, if I can find the right one here. Long before things get bad, and then I just put down, openness is healthy anytime, even when things are going okay, to be open for advice anytime.
Anyone else?
I agree with that. When you wait to ask for help, when it's not going the best, you're too late already. Never too late, but I think when things are going good, you need to evaluate the health of your company and listen to people and communicate with others.
If you're at a place that you're needing to make some apologetic phone calls for not getting bills paid, I would hope you're at a place that you are seeking some help. I will say I was very blessed. There is a young Amish couple that started a cafe, I guess you call it, and they have called us numerous times and just letting us know that they didn't forget about the bill they have with us and hope to continue to do work into the future. And it goes a long way, but I guess one question I have after several calls, is there anyone helping them to figure it out?
What I noted here on this one is what I tell clients on marketing, you market when it's good times, not when it's bad. Because when you need the sales, you don't have time to go market and advertise to get it, because there's a cycle that it takes to get it. The same way with this, I noted you should be asking for advice and direction when things are going very well. Because if you wait until things are bad, then your options become so much more limited.
Can I hire you?
I've told them that many a time, but they don't seem to get it. They always wait to spend their marketing money until they're in bad times and don't have it.
Matthew, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, it's a humbling experience to reach out for help, and the quicker you do it, the better off you are if you realize that you're needing some help. And even especially before you're in trouble, that's the best time to try to avert the problem, because once the holes gets deeper, then it gets harder to fix it. So earlier the better, and it's a mentality that you've built up until then.
So the question was good. The question asked what the proper time is and what the needful time is. The proper time is all the time, when it's going well, and the needful time is maybe when the bills aren't being paid or you're having trouble, you need to call vendors and make arrangements, or you're bouncing checks, things like that. Number four, what should a church do if they see a business struggle and the owner doesn't want help or see the need for help? So I'll just open it up to any of you to go first.
So we do a lot of business advising, and kind of internally, we always say the only time that we have failed is when we give business advice. The only time we failed is when they don't listen. And so you have that problem when someone needs help, but they don't want it. And I still remember someone that said that saying is you can't lead a horse to water and make it drink. But then someone added on to it, but oh yes, you can feed them salt.
Norman, what are your thoughts?
It is. You just can't help a person that doesn't want to be helped. So when you see that, who was you talking about? Get a good relationship with the person. so they can trust you as leaders in the church. And then just approach them and see if you can't get them to where they recognize it. But if they simply do not want help, what can you do other than let them go until they're flat against the wall?
I think we have to be careful as leadership that we don't carry the air that we are Mr. Fix-It. I feel, at least maybe in Mennonite circles, that we haven't done such a good job of walking very graciously beside people and humbly beside people. They've turned into a church project, and I think there's some fear of that happening, and that's partially why people don't reach out maybe as soon as they should. It's not a confidential brother to brother. It's more, I'm here to fix you, and you are my project.
Anyone else?
I want to add a little bit something that I just lately, a business was in trouble for quite a while. So he approached the church and wanted help. And so they assigned a couple people, and they basically took over. Because he approached them, he let them take over. But they didn't know what they were doing, and they created a bigger disaster. To tell you the truth, they should have come to AF and gotten help.
It's good advice to come to a place that for sure can help us, not to someone that's going to tell us what we want to hear. Maybe I can appeal to the owners of troubled businesses. If we have a troubled business, let's reach out. Let's reach out. Let's be humble. And appreciate the advice to the church brethren that we would be humble and walk beside them and not turn them into a project, but rather walk together.
Add one thought I had with that is we've had a fair number of clients come to us that are in trouble, and they wanted us to help because they didn't want to go to the church. And maybe one of the things that the church could do is establish a relationship, but also be able to help them find the correct help that they need if a church is not capable, but to support them through that, because bad times are very, very emotional, spiritually. It's extremely hard times when people go through that.
Excellent thought. Let's move on to number 5. Give some advice on how to handle the termination of a church brother or family member's employment. How can this be handled in a way that relationships are not damaged? Howard, I think we'll start with you.
I don't have a lot of experience on this, but I feel, again, humility is huge in this regard. We had one situation where I was hoping it could be a mutually agreed upon separation, but it ended not quite going that way. And I, in love to the individual, offered to assist financially for them to get some Christian counseling, because I felt there were deeper issues that were part of the equation that would only surface wherever they go. And that was one way I tried to show love, by paying their way to find their way from here.
So I had an employee situation where I had to actually fire the best man that was at my wedding. That was not an easy situation to go through. It was not a brother in the church at that time. And so some of the things that I would just note as this is that I've learned over the years, and I also parted way with my brother in business. The Lord opened the door and found another opportunity that he took, that it didn't come to a firing or things with that. But you do have to remember, you are a steward. You do have a business to run. And too often you're trying to run a business and somebody may not be helping you well or anymore. They may be hindering that. And you are responsible for your business. The other one that I would comment is that has taken a lot off my shoulders. It is the employee's responsibility to fix the situation, not you as the employer. So the solutions should come from the employee, not from the employer. And that was a big relief to me, because so often you want to run around trying to fix that employee's problem. You want to make it work for them. They want to do that. So I would recommend you at least have a minimum of 3 meetings where you sit down with that person. First meeting is, here's the gap, here's the situation, we need to close it. It's serious. You need to go think about it, get back to me with what the solution is, and it's their job to fix it. So when they bring the solution back to you at meeting number two, if it's a great solution, then you solve the problem, you put it into place, and it all ends well. If they can't bring a solution back to you, then you need to reemphasize that it's severe because we don't have a solution to this issue. We need to get this gap closed, and that they need to go think about it again and really get a solution to it. And the third time, if they come back and they still don't have any solution, then it's pretty obvious that there's not a solution. You as the employer don't have a solution either. And it's time to part ways or let them go, even if they don't want to let them go because it can't be resolved. And then I note this because sadly, this is where we get some feelings and things with that, but just because a season ends doesn't mean it was a bad season. Too often when we end a season, we retroactively think the season was terrible. It was terrible I ever worked for you, and that's not the case. It was a good season. And so you have to generally remember that there will ultimately always be an end to every season. So someone will eventually quit for you, they may die, or there's always an end to a season, and we're gonna have to learn how to handle them.
Anyone else?
I would tend to think because of the question involves a church brother or a family member, I think spreading it out amongst, you know, some older brethren in the church, or, you know, having the ministry, spreading it out to several people's counsel, I think, could be a security.
What else?
What kind of agreements do you have in place? I'm just going to circle back with is there an employment agreement in place that's in violation? Is this a personal issue? And have you given proper steps to retribution? Has there been a clear line of closing the gap, as was, I like that terminology. Have you sat down and painted that? You don't just come to this point overnight. There's been a buildup to this, and what does that buildup look like? What foundation are you working on?
All right, I think we'll move on. Thank you for that. Number six, is there a formula that a business should use to determine what a healthy cash reserve is? Nathan, you're the accountant.
Yeah, I made some notes on this. I have my steps that we teach or go through. Number one, I think you all know this, cash is king. Doesn't matter how profitable you are, doesn't matter how successful you are, when your checkbook is empty, you're dead. If you can't pay bills and things, doesn't matter if you're profitable, you're in a bad spot. So this is kind of the pecking order, or the order that I say that a business should function from. Number one is, I'm a big advocate of a line of credit that you have places to go in and out, but number one, pay all your bills weekly as possible. Show people that you have the money, you pay it, your money's gold. So number one, pay all your bills weekly if possible. Don't listen to those people that are like, you know, your vendors or your bank. Get a good reputation there. Number two, if you still have cash left, then pay your line and keep paying on your line of credit till that gets down to zero. And then when you need money, you can always get it back from your line of credit. Then third is build a cash reserve so that you do have a little bit of a cash buffer, that you got the cash liquidity, number three. And then number four is when you get to the point of paying down your long-term debt. Once you have a line of credit there and some cash reserve, then get to taking and tackling your long-term debt. Does that answer the exact formula for a healthy cash reserve? No, not necessarily, because every situation is different with that. But cash is king, so I always like to try to keep as big a cash liquidity, get as big a line of credits as you can get so that you have access to it. But again, if you're a person that burns a hole in your pocket, then maybe you shouldn't do that, because some people, if they have it, they always want to spend it.
What else?
I'm not sure how this all factors in, but we have the understanding, the equipment that depreciates very rapidly. We try hard to pay that with cash up front before we go ahead, as much as possible. And my theory is, if suddenly that piece of equipment has to stand still because of a recession, it won't be costing us anything to have it there.
And I think for the answer of how much, if you're in a seasonal business, that answer is probably in front of you. How many months of downtime do you have? How many months of things slow? That would be a window into what reserve you ought to have. But the truth is, you can have as big a reserve as you want, and it could not be enough.
I did think of one thing, and pardon the example of it, but a good test in a business is if someone showed up and put a gun to your head and said, give me all your money, it is interesting to go process through sometimes as a company, how much cash could you cough up in a day? That really does tell you where your liquidity is at, like from your line of credit to your checkbook to, like, if I was forced to do that, what kind of liquidity do I have?
Very interesting. All right, let's move on to number 7. I'm going to try to summarize this question a little bit. Is there any value in tracking the dollar value of mistakes, especially as relates to manufacturing? And we're thinking of mistakes that the company is making internally. So in our company, we would call this an internal mistake. The vendor didn't do us wrong, we did wrong. And so something is clearly our fault. So do we track the dollar value? Do we track who's responsible? Do you have any suggestions how to remedy in-house internal mistakes? Matthew, go ahead with this.
Yes, you should be tracking those. I mean, you're losing the money, so somewhere there's been a failure that needs to be fixed. But be careful. I don't think you should be tracking that in a public manner. I think the management should be tracking that at an executive level and addressing the problem where the problem is. Somebody has failed. Some step in the process has failed, that this money is getting lost. And somewhere there needs to be that needs to be fixed. So by all means, track it and address it, but privately. Don't publicly humiliate. Publicly humiliating people is not going to get them motivated.
I think there's value if we know what the cost is of our mistakes. It helps to for the future. I said that I work with a co-pastor that's an ex-Marine. Another story he likes to tell is the company that had a $500,000 mistake made, and the employees were disgruntled with the person that made the mistake and thought he should be fired. And the owner said, why would I fire someone after I just trained him with a $500,000? I think how we handle the mistakes that are made. I had a employee recently that felt very bad about a mistake he made. And he said he felt bad all weekend. He hated it like crazy, but he said the company where he worked at before would have handled it a lot differently than what my CEO did. And I think we have to remember we're Christians, and hopefully we can learn from our mistakes.
Especially in production, manufacturing, when the end product is, when you have a whole tub full of products that is one hole is an eighth inch off and it's all junk, you know, it's pretty bad. And so wherever the mistake, you have to trace it down to where the mistake was made. Then you can have to figure out, and so often we have found out the mistake was not the person. It was the process wasn't clearly defined. The prints were, the expectations weren't clearly defined. And I think it's just a matter of now we know to fix that so it doesn't happen again. So I think it's a lot of the communication and the process that you have isn't clearly defined, and that's important.
Turn the focus to the process, not the person.
That's right.
My 21-year-old son, I wish I could have said this was my quote, and I'm not sure where he had it and brought it, but I really liked it, and that is the quote that failure is not final. Failure is fertilizer. And so I also told I didn't get there yet. I keep joking about it. I say I'm going to write a book called Managing Your Dunghill, because I feel like as a leader, all you deal with in the day is all these mistakes and problems that come to the top. But when you look at this and these failures in a company, one of the most beautiful things is if you do take the manure, the stinky parts, and use that as fertilizer, that is what makes things grow. And as a leader, you have to take that from the top and take it back as fertilizer, and that will actually make your company flourish when you handle the mistakes well.
Nevin, do you have anything yet?
I don't. I just don't have a lot of experience. We're pretty small, so.
One of the things I would encourage is to build into your cost a bit of a percentage, a small percentage that you can set aside that will cover mistakes or warranties. That's been very helpful for us, and that settles management down because they have it built into the plan. All right, let's move on to number 8. This is two questions that I'm going to put together. Should interest rates be at, below, or above 5%? And why do you believe this? So it's an interesting question. And then along with that, after that, are low interest or interest-free loans to young people or businesses healthy or fair as a general rule? What about the references of the Old Testament scripture about charging usury to your brother? So Nathan, we'll start with you again on this one.
It's a very good question that happens a lot. Usury usually meant the exorbitant interest rates. And if you want to know what usury is, just don't pay your credit card bill and you'll experience it with that. And then you come to the place of saying, hey, you know, and I've had that happen on my side too. There's people that are like, hey, I want to help somebody get started. I want to do that. So I don't want to charge you interest rates. But we do legally have in the U.S. of where you have to charge at least the applicable federal rate. The applicable federal rate, IRS actually has rates that are out there that are applicable for the terms, whether it's a 10-year, 15-year, 30-year, whatever. And you can go on and you can Google it. I just looked what the applicable federal rate was for a 10-year loan paid monthly today in the month of February, and it is 4.62%. So you can find that, and so technically, if there is a loan under 4.62%, then you are gifting the interest to them. And you're actually, for tax purposes, supposed to figure it as if the interest was paid, but then it was given back as a gift. And so I think it is important that if you are going to gift interest or gift the value of money to somebody, they should know what they're being gifted, and they should be figuring the appropriate cost into their overhead and know what it's actually costing them to do business. Because I've seen people continue in business that because people help them, they keep struggling along, but if they had to do it at fair prices, they'd be out of business. So you gotta be careful that you're not helping somebody do something that they really shouldn't be doing because you're giving them gifts.
Thank you, what else?
Well, I agree with that. The other thing is, you know, when you're using somebody else's money, inflation, if you pay no interest or don't add anything, inflation is taking away the value just in itself.
That was 2.7% last year, so if you're not paying 2.7%, then you're actually getting a gift anyway. You think it might have been too high? I understand.
No, it wasn't questionable. It's just I question it. I say it's fact.
Yeah, I think we all agree with that and understand that. Any more on this interest rate? So I think we've answered that question about the 5% rate. And then any more thoughts on giving loans to startups? All right, go ahead, Matthew.
I would say that, you know, we get in different seasons of our life, and the older people have got, maybe they've been successful, and it's a good way to give a little bit of a boost to the younger generation. No interest, I would probably not support that. I would think that it should be a low interest rate that's still fair for the older generation to make a solid return. You're not losing money. And I don't think it's being fair to the younger people either to be exceptionally low, because they need to develop some business muscles and understand that, you know, it's real money, and real money costs real money. And so low interest, loans to a brother, I would support those.
And there are a lot of loan groups scattered out amongst the Plain people. I would encourage young folks and those with money to loan to use a loan group if you have one in your local community. Use it. That gives a little cushion between borrower and lender that can really help out.
Put a good agreement in place, please.
Yes, we would want to remember the agreements. All right, let's move on. We're going to take a couple questions now. Let's do the meeting question next. How do you conduct meetings? And there's a list of them here, staff meetings, meetings. Any information on how, when, who? Interested in ideas from the panel on that. How do you conduct an effective meeting?
I'm not going to go after the conduction of the meeting. It's just in business. I'll give you what we do. You need to have the meetings. They're valuable. So in my company, we have monthly staff meetings where we meet with all of the employees. The managers meet once a month with every employee, and the teams meet every week. And I have a lot of remote people, and they did not like it, but it was required unless they had a really good excuse. We always have weekly team meetings. They had to join with a webcam so we could actually see their face, hear them. And that really turned around the teams because the people actually felt part of the team and things then because they actually had a weekly meeting. So make sure you have the meetings and you'll learn how to conduct them.
Well, I think when you do meetings, make sure that you have a chairman that's going to take the lead in the meeting, and then have an agenda and make the meeting as productive as you can, and that will encourage them to come back to a meeting again if they know it's. I think it's really important that the meetings are often enough, not too often, and very productive.
I've seen a sticker that says, I just left a meeting that should have been an email. And so be careful with your meetings. You can overdo that too. There's a lot of unproductive meetings out there, and I hate unproductive meetings, so I'd probably veer on the other side. But keep them structured. Keep the meaningful people there. If you have people there that can't change what you're trying to change, don't have them in the meeting. But definitely have meetings. I'm not going to go into what should be weekly and what should be monthly. I do believe there should be board meetings at least quarterly, update calls monthly. That's kind of how we structure ours. And then from there on down, let the operations people schedule their own meetings. And if you're not contributing to the meeting, then just get me off the invitation.
Howard.
We have stand-up meetings Monday morning for various departments, mostly to organize the work for the week. But what has been a blessing for us is we do have monthly, we call them sales meetings, but really what it's about, it's inviting the managers that are going to be inheriting the projects that are being sold at some point. We invite them in on the sales meeting, and it just builds rapport. They get to see what's in the pipeline. They get to hear the salesman talk about how the transaction went in getting this landed and some of the details that went into that. And we found that to be very upbuilding as a team to get that overview.
Anything else? And AF has some good resources. There's USB sticks back on the table. There is Leading Effective Meetings by Leonard Meter. That's a very good one. That's number 7104. You'll find that helpful. Also, Merle Herr wrote a book, A Serving Leader's Guide to Effective Meetings. Look up that book. That will take you very in-depth, and it's a very good book. All right, let's move on to these two questions here are pay-related. Can anyone share some good ideas on how to pay a sales commission to a person in your company who's making the sales? This would be in addition to regular wages, wanting it to be an incentive and a bonus. How it works if he gets a sales commission on top of his wages and the rest of the employees don't have this opportunity.
So my thought with this one is that I think in our companies that we need to be very, very conscious and careful that employment, that our wages and salaries and things is confidential, needs to be confidential, because frankly, life is not fair, and it's not fair in what we do. The devil himself never plays fair. He always hits you at the worst time that possible, so life isn't always fair, and it doesn't always make sense with some of the things in life. Sales tends to be commission based on that as an incentive, and there's a lot of people that pay that way to get them motivated. And so I do think there is good ways to do that. When you go to the rest of the company and they find out that somebody gets commissioned, they don't, one of the answers to that would be is then, well, do you want to go sell? Because if you want commission, you can go sell door to door. Most of them are like, no, I'll go back and I'll just work, because they don't want to be salesmen. But I would also throw this out. One of the greatest conflicts I've always seen is between sales and production. So we motivate our sales guys, and so they're salespeople, and they sell heavily, and then there's conflict with production. And so I've really started pondering, maybe we should salary our sales guys, our salespeople, so that they bring good work in and they take good care of the production side, because you can't sell something that you can't produce with that. So that's just some of my thoughts.
What else?
I know on our solar side, on our solar business, the salesmen, they're on commission. And probably the highest paying man in the whole business is our lead salesman. But that man works. And I don't think any of the install crew, anybody, would want to do the hours that he does. And it's not, you know, 9 to 5. He's out there, he needs to travel, he does, but he gets well compensated. And a lot of, when they're working on the sales commission, it's very based on their performance. And so there is a difference between the production and, but I agree with that. It needs to be a good relationship of what can actually be done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
It's hard to find another KPI for a salesman besides what he's sold, unless you have it, you know, based on profits. So it's very standard to have a salesman being on commission, and I support that. So the key performance indicator should be maybe profits instead of sales. But then the second half of that question is another issue in itself. If you have people talking about their wages and discussing it over the lunch table, then you just need to deal with that as well.
I will add this one I just thought of. A lot of salespeople are compensated, but managers, if they manage a division, you usually know what the dollars are that they manage. And so managers managing something can also be paid commission to oversee the production.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do have a little more buy-in between, because when an extra sale comes in, they actually have a partnership with it.
Go ahead, Howard.
That's one thing we had a very touchy situation a number of years ago when we moved from providing vehicles for our salespeople. Some of the other senior employees around there, especially the managers, didn't get a vehicle. So we did a little compensation for them in travel allowance, gas money. Instead, in lieu of getting them a vehicle, which helped ease some of the pain.
Excellent. One of the things I would suggest to lessen the pressure on the sales team would be to have a base salary that covers their needs. Their basic needs and requirements are met by a base salary, and the commission is on top of that, maybe based upon profitability. That takes a little bit of the pressure off. When if somebody takes a unique individual to go in and it's totally a commission, and there's a lot of pressure that that person can face. Any other thoughts before we move on? All right, let's take the last one I have. What is a good method to pay employees for events that require long distance travel for business? Requires extra time, as Norman was talking about, sometimes include long distance travel. What are your thoughts?
We had some of the stickiest employee situations, not for the long distance ones, but just for some of the most simplistic ones, where you had a company supper for the employees, and then you say, okay, you can put your time down, but when does it start and stop? Is it compensated? Isn't it compensated? How should that be compensated? How late in the evening can they talk at the supper till it gets paid for? And then next time you say it's not compensated, then they're upset because they weren't compensated, and then why should I come to the supper for a company event not be paid? And so we got back to, we have to be very clear on company events that it's paid or not paid, whether you're required to be there, not required to be there. And we got to the place of whenever you have those extracurricular events, go more to a salary mindset. So we'll have a training day that people travel in, and so there may be extended hours, but we say when you do the training day, then you're paid for 8 hours. That takes away the miscellaneous stuff. It's just, it's the event for the day, you get paid for 8 hours. You may have 10 hours of time. Or got people going to shows, traveling to events and things, and if you're paid by the hour, instead of saying you're paid by the hour, you're like, okay, we're just going to give you X dollars a day for that event with that, and get a little bit away from the hourly, because sometimes you don't know how to figure that when somebody's away long distance. Just go to a flat rate.
Excellent. What other answers?
I believe legally you're required to pay them if it's a required event. How you exactly pay that, how you compensate them is probably between you and your employees, but you should pay them if it's a required event. We face that in our company. There's a lot of training required, and we'll sit in this room full of people, and they're all on the clock for 4 days a year, and we're required to pay them.
Okay. Makes sense. Well, that brings us to the close of this session. Thank you for putting yourself out and answering these questions. We appreciate it. And thank you for turning the questions in. Hopefully that you with me have learned some things from their experience. There's quite a few years of experience represented up front, and thank you for allowing us to tap that.